I'm Bruce Gilley. I'm a professor of political science at Portland State University, and I study politics and development both in the present and in the past.
Professor Gilley, thank you very much indeed for talking to the History Reclaim podcast series. We feel very pleased to have you down the line, as we say, in broadcasting. History Reclaimed published an article, an 8,500-word article, on the case for colonialism, which, when you first published in 2017, got taken down. Can you just explain a little bit of that history, if you like, of being no-platformed?
Well, I was preparing to write a biography of the former British colonial official Sir Alan Burns, and part of his main sort of thrust of his life was to make the case for colonialism. And as I was going through his writings and his speeches and his memoirs and his diaries, I was trying to think that I needed to sort of set up the framework idea of what is the case for colonialism before jumping into this book project. And so I wrote this article called The Case for Colonialism. It was not just the case for colonialism in the past, but also the case for colonialism in the present, the case for reviving some form of colonial rule in failed states where people's lives are in utter misery. And I sent it to the Third World Quarterly, which was a kind of respectable, typical lefty academic journal, but that, you know, generally has been curious and ambitious. I had published there before. They put it through peer review. It got one positive, one negative. The editor decided to run it, which was his prerogative when you get a split decision. And within minutes of it appearing in its online version in 2017, a great mob arose, a hue and cry. We can't publish these things. This is intellectual violence. This is dangerous for brown and black people everywhere. And the end result was they started getting death threats at their editorial office in London. And I then agreed that the paper should be taken down in the interest of the safety of those people.
And you got death threats, and your family did too, I believe.
Yes, death threats coming to my home office, some people being kind enough to leave their name and number after giving their death threat, which was kind of charming. And then we ended up republishing the article in Academic Questions, which is the house journal of the National Association of Scholars here in the United States, on whose board I serve, which defends academic freedom everywhere.
And of course, you can now read it on the History Reclaimed website. But to go back, you have found another publisher now, after being subject to what we call the no platform cancel culture. Can you tell us a little bit about why Sir Alan Burns was the last imperialist?
Well, yeah, actually, both the article was deplatformed and then found a new publisher in Academic Questions. And then the book itself, which was originally to be published with Roman and Littlefield, was also deplatformed by another mob, a separate mob, and again then found another publisher in Regnery Gateway. So that book, The Last Imperialist, is now out. Burns, I describe him as the last imperialist, not because he is the last person to, you know, turn off the lights in British colonial rule. That would have been, you know, Chris Patten for all intents and purposes. But he is the last imperialist in the sense of he's the last person in the high tide of imperial rule in the 50s and 60s to be making a full-throated defense of the British imperial and colonial achievement, when others are starting to and ah and talk about the balance sheet and, well, dear boy, let's not talk about it. And Burns is unapologetic in his defense of the British Empire and more generally in defense of European empires as a whole, which I think distinguishes him. And that's why I call him the last imperialist.
And you've published that book now, or about to. Who with?
With Regnery Gateway, which is a publisher here in the United States, which is famous for taking up books that have been deplatformed by the mainstream media. And they are famous also for a series of books called The Politically Incorrect Guides to, one of which is The Politically Incorrect Guide to the British Empire, which I highly recommend.
Sir Alan Burns, if he had a unique contribution, what would you define that as being?
I think Burns's contribution was to make the case for what I would call liberal imperialism, which is to say the case that if we care about human outcomes, if we care about human flourishing, if we are vigorously focused on good outcomes, then we need to think carefully about the sequencing of political and economic development in different places, which have different inheritances. And his main contribution was to make what I would call that empirical argument for colonialism, which is that it was necessary in many places, that it was terminated abruptly in many places. And it's not just that he was making the argument, he was walking the walk as well, because everywhere he went, his record bespeaks a very careful and diligent effort to build up the foundations of self-government and human flourishing. And so his contribution, I think, is to make the liberal case for empire. And that's, I think, his sort of lasting legacy, not just in his arguments, but also in his practice.
But if we look at the scale of violence, the atrocities which are often cited, which has discredited imperialism as a concept, can they possibly be defended?
I think they can, and there's sort of two responses to that. One is I always like to say, well, which atrocity in particular, because I'm always interested in these so-called sort of slam dunk cases which discredit imperialism, and I've yet to find one, not even one, that discredits imperialism. But let's assume and let's agree that there are, in every case of imperialism, in every form of colonial rule, in addition to every case of pre-colonial rule and indigenous rule, there are cases of violence and atrocities that are inexcusable, that are mistakes, that are wrong. Do they ever rise to the level of discrediting the system as a whole? And I would say there's not a single case, not just the British Empire, but in any European empire, where that was true. Now, of course, if you rule a very large territory with many people over many years, there will be many cases of violence and atrocities that are disproportionate to whatever threat is justified to mobilize that the violence, or what I would call counterinsurgency, I think is a better word, or security operations against insurgencies that want to throw these countries back to their Stone Age past. And what's specific and interesting about European empires is they have accountability mechanisms. You know, we know about these things because there were accountability mechanisms in place. There were hearings, there were trials, there was media, there was civil society, there was consequences within colonial administration for doing this. Of course, none of that was true in the pre-colonial systems, and that certainly was not the case in any of the post-colonial states as well. So it's a bit of a sort of Eurocentric approach, actually, to focus on colonial violence and not focus on pre-colonial or post-colonial violence or the violence that took place in places that were not colonized. So I find the argument uncompelling. And on the other hand, I'm very proud, you know, to note about colonialism that it left in place vast archives and testimonies and court records and hearings that anti-colonial scholars can pore over at their pleasure.
But if I take issue of something you've just said, that they can go back to their Stone Age ways, to paraphrase it, your sentence, doesn't that insult cultures such as the indigenous Indians in America?
Well, yes, I don't think it's an insult to say that all human groups arise from developmental conditions which are characterized by the use of stone, not steel. That's just a truism about all human societies. And no, I don't think it's insulting to say that. I mean, it's no more insulting than to say that when the Romans reached where it is now Hadrian's Wall, they looked at the Scots and decided they were not worth colonizing. I'm of Scottish ancestry. I don't feel insulted to read the descriptions of Scotland by the Romans, which said they were basically naked apes running around chasing deer in the Highlands. Do I feel insulted by that? Does that traumatize me? No, absolutely not. That was the true fact of Scottish development at the time of the Roman conquest. So every human society goes through a developmental process. Human societies differed vastly in their state of development at the time of the European encounter. The reason the European encounter spread was because Europe had kind of accelerated past every other civilization. And that was just a descriptive fact. I mean, if descriptive facts are insulting, well, I guess, you know, people need to come to terms with the reality of historical development. I think the question is, how do you move forward towards a modern society?
And well, can I ask you then, process. Professor Gilley, how do you move forward to a modern society? And how do you let history be revised? As you must acknowledge, history does go through revisionist periods, and it certainly is now. But how do we move on from that?
Well, I think there's a sense in which history, the writing of history, goes through phases, which are, you know, invariably shaped by the conditions in which history is being written. So at the high tide of imperialism, I would say before 1914, much of what is being written about, you know, social and human development has a very kind of Darwinian character to it. It's very much about the stronger and the more modern must conquer the weaker and the less modern. And there is a kind of tinge of superiority about it, which is invariable and necessary. Then as the anti-colonial movements begin, which is really kind of coinciding with the fact that these places are developing, you get the big backlash. You get the beginning of anti-colonial movements, and with that, the beginning of anti-colonial historiography, which, by the way, mostly starts among white Europeans and is then taken up by people in the colonies. So I think we've been living with that anti-colonial historiography for the last 100 years, essentially. And I think now is the time to start to look back and say, okay, now that we've sort of cast off imperialism, can we be more objective? Because what the need is today is for a more objective account of colonialism, because there's many parts of the world which could use, with good governance, which is overseen and managed by external forces, and I think a lot of populations would embrace that. And what a lot of things I've been writing about for the last sort of 5 years is the ways in which colonialism is being seen as something that can be learned from again in these places where people suffer from dysfunctional post-colonial governments.
So would you like to see colonialism put back on the international affairs agenda?
Yeah, I think partly it's a question of words, and people say, well, just don't call it colonialism. But I'm not one for euphemisms. I think if we're talking about external control of the sovereignty of a place or of part of a country or of a certain part of its government, often finance or policing or security, I think there's no problem with calling that colonialism rather than, you know, external sovereignty, because I think what it does is it helps us not evade the historical record. And I think until we come to terms with an accurate account of colonialism and see that it was operating in very difficult circumstances, much like today, we won't be able to operate a successful external governance operation today, because every time there's a corrupt official, or every time someone gets shot unintentionally, there'll be a hue and cry. And I think we need to understand that's the reality of these situations. They're not perfect situations, but I think a lot could be learned and achieved by bringing back forms of rule which bring a more liberal and established and high-capacity government to bear to help places develop the conditions for real self-government, not fake self-government with postage stamps and flags and tyranny.
And I suppose from that, you've got to be able to study the past and speak about it, because the no-platform culture, you'll know from what happened to your article back in 2017 on the case for colonialism, you're not allowed to say things anymore. The so-called woke culture and the age of apology, even the platforms where historians are asked to speak, say, for instance, on Churchill, they're not balanced. People get shouted down. Are you surprised by that, and have you been subject to it?
I'm not surprised by it. In some sense, when I took up this project, I was prepared for it. But I think what always gives me hope and encouragement is I get letters practically every day now from people in the former colonies, a lot of people from India, a lot of people from Africa, who say to me, thank you for speaking on our behalf, because we are tired of having our history controlled by mostly white professors in film studies, linguistics, in Western universities, who never have to worry about where their next meal is coming from, who sit there and tell us that we're not allowed to think creatively about our colonial past. And I think what encourages me is I get letters from people in Nigeria, in India, Ghana, Uganda, Pakistan, who say to me, keep doing what you're doing, because we ourselves need to come to terms with this in a productive and a fruitful manner. And we have no problems thinking that we have lessons to learn for our country from that colonial past. So that, to me, being deplatformed by woke professors at Oxford, really, I think that they're just a decadent manifestation of the plenty we have in a Western society. But when I get letters from people in the colonies saying, keep doing what you're doing, it really encourages me.
And the death threats back in 2017, are you still subject to those?
No, I think they realized, you know, the way the mob works is they look for signs of vulnerability and weakness. They look for people to start apologizing and saying, I didn't realize how much harm I would cause. And although I briefly did that when the first mob arose, I quickly realized that was the road to perdition. And I think the mob has realized that I don't back down now. And so they've given up. That's how mobs work. They're basically feckless and timorous groups that look for vulnerability. And once you say, no, I'm not apologizing, the problem is not me but you, then they tend to move and find another victim very quickly.
And social media, Twitter, do you engage in it?
Yes, I'm on Twitter, and I'm fine on Twitter in the sense that I think people that want to engage me seriously don't use that medium for it. And I think it's a useful way to communicate. I don't think it's a useful way to have a discussion. But I think in terms of communication, that's a good way to go. And I've met a lot of great friends on Twitter.
And just finally, are you surprised by the number of supporters you now have? Because it must have felt very lonely, you know, 4 years ago, having your article taken down, having publishers withdraw their offers to publish your books. I mean, it must have been a lonely experience, but now, of course, we've got the History Reclaimed website.
Right, and I think it's a reminder of what we often call the room outside the room. And it's clear now that the censorious and illiberal forces that dominate many questions in mainstream media, in the mainstream established academic institutions, that small room, that small and incestuous room, is really not reflective of broader society and what most educated, reasonable, and liberal people think about historical questions and others. And that's the bigger, what I would say, the room outside the room, of which History Reclaimed is an important part. And so it's always important to remind yourself that in some ways the passion and anger inside the room is a reflection of how much they recognize that they're not representative, that they are not the smart people, and the smart people are actually outside the room. And slowly that larger public does come out and support you and get in touch. It's slow, and it's easy to lose your nerve at first, but just always recognizing that, you know, the world is full of basically reasonable and liberal people. And what has happened in the contemporary academy and mainstream media is really a kind of descent into unrepresentativeness, which I think we're actually seeing the results of now as new groups arise to counter them.
So you don't think it's just a younger generation thing, that they'll snap out of it in some way, that you think there is progress now and people are moving on?
Yeah, I think actually that the polls show that our younger generation is actually far more reasonable than the kind of establishment who's in their 30s, 40s, and 50s now. They are actually the problem. They're the ones who grew up in the 60s and got their PhDs in the 60s with radical professors, and now they're in charge. But I think the younger generation is sick and tired of cancel culture, and I think we will see progress.
And any advice, soundbites, to students who want to study history today? Surely they should be curious and read books on both sides of the fence.
Yeah, I think my advice to a history student is take your professor's syllabus and find everything possible you can read that takes a different approach to your professor's syllabus, and thereby showing not just your curiosity, but also your integrity as an intellectual. Don't let your professor stampede you into their views. And I would say that should apply to my own students as well. And I tell them to make sure that they read outside of what I've assigned them. And I think curiosity is really the ultimate defense against censorship.
And we'll go back just finally to Sir Alan Burns. Do you think he'd agree with you, the last imperialist?
You know, Sir Alan Burns, I think what attracts me to him is he didn't really have much time or truck for intellectual and theoretical debates. He himself never went to university. He only had 2 years of what we would now say high school at St. Edmund's College in the UK. He was a practical man of a practical bent, although he was very prolific as a writer and as a speechmaker. He was actually a great intellectual, but he never posed as an intellectual.
So Sir Alan Burns was an intellectual, but he didn't pose as one. Perhaps there are lessons in that for all of us today.
Yes, I like that a lot. I think that's a great way to summarize his life.
Professor Bruce Gilley, thank you very much indeed for talking to the History Reclaimed podcast series today. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And you can find out more about the History Reclaim podcasts and articles on www.historyreclaimed.co.uk. Thank you for listening.